Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Physical Attraction. I've been excited about this for a while. Today on the show, for the first time ever, we have not one, but two guests who have co-written an excellent book together. They're both currently researching nuclear fusion, and they've written a book about the future of fusion energy called, well, The Future of Fusion Energy. Dr. Justin Ball is currently studying plasma theory at Lausanne, and Jason Parisi works on turbulent transport in highly magnetised plasmas just a few buildings away from me here at the University of Oxford. Their book is an excellent guide to the science, history, and future of fusion energy, and a real help in compiling the marathon run that the show has had so far. So I was excited to be able to grab both of them for an interview to talk about fusion. Since this comes after I've already been yakking about fusion for ages, the conversation does assume some knowledge of what nuclear fusion is, but should be easy to follow if you've listened to some of the episodes in this series already. This is the second part of the interview with Justin and Jason. It doesn't really depend on the first part, so you can dive right in here if you're a kind of non-linear person, but you may want to listen to the first part first. Without further ado, then, the authors of The Future of Fusion Energy.
Yeah, so I think this brings us on quite nicely then to chapter 9 of the book, where you talk to, obviously, Justin, you are associated yourself with Commonwealth Fusion Systems, but also there's lots of other startups that are out there that all have various different methods by which they're trying to, I made a solemn pledge once that I would never use the word disrupt in this sense, but yeah, disrupt the fusion industry. I hate myself. It's fine. I can edit it out. It's all good. these startups that said they would get a leg over, they would beat ITER to the punch by using some sort of ingenious new type of solution. And ultimately, I suppose, in some ways, it's a question of letting many flowers bloom and hoping that one of them stumbles upon. And as you've said, sometimes Mother Nature throws you a bone, right? And there's a wonderful plasma configuration mm-hmm. that no one has seen before, that there's nothing really in the laws of physics, I suppose, that really prevent you from discovering something like that, particularly when you're exposing the plasma to new kinds of approach. But for the course of writing the book, did you get a chance to interview lots of the people involved in these fusion startups? What was that like? And could you tell us about some of them?
I'm sure. Yeah. So we reached out to a lot of them with varying degrees of success. And so like some are quite secretive. For instance, like Lockheed Martin, we couldn't even find like an email address to send. Others, you know, like Commonwealth Fusion is very closely associated with the academic community.
And so some of their stuff has been published in the recent past, right? Which is not the case for a private company like Lockheed that barely needs to publish anything that they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. And so, for example, TAE Energy was really nice and sat down with a Skype interview with us. And, tokamaks are really complicated. There's been a bunch of research on them. All of these fusion startups are as complicated as tokamaks in terms of from a physics perspective. And so you know, even us as fusion scientists, it's really difficult to wrap our heads around how these devices work, what's their potential drawbacks, what are their potential advantages. And so, you know, more information is always better. And so, like, for example, TAE and also General Fusion did a good job of like walking us through how they see their device and how they envision it working.
Just to bring on to one in particular, General Fusion. So the concept that they have, as I understand it, and again, you've talked to them, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they have a device where you inject your deuterium tritium fuel into the center of this kind of spinning vortex of molten metal. And then they have all of these pistons on the outside of their device. And the idea is that they're all going to simultaneously, you know, to within a few fractions of a millisecond, compress all of that, all of that molten metal at the same time, and cause a kind of spherical shock wave that will come in and compress that inner fuel capsule. And so in some ways it's similar to what inertial confinement fusion scientists with lasers were trying to do, where you compress a capsule to a very, very, very small size, very high temperatures and densities, and it hopefully produces enough energy to make that whole effort that you'd set up beforehand worthwhile. And it just astonishes me that this device could work, because it seems, and maybe I'm being naive here, but it seems like they had a real problem with NIF, the National Ignition Facility, and other laser devices, getting anything that was sufficiently spherically symmetric to compress their capsule down to this size. And the idea that if you can't do it with lasers, you could do it mechanically with pistons and so on is just amazing to me. So, I mean, how did they talk about their device and how they viewed it? And, you know, have I missed a trick in the description that makes it seem more feasible?
So, I mean, their design has changed somewhat as they've learned more about it. And so I think initially it was what you're talking about, where they have these huge pistons that just, you know, slam on this liquid metal and propagate a shockwave through. Which just like, you know, it seemed like a very violent shockwave, and it seems like it would, you know, cause liquid metal to go in the plasma and lead to be everywhere. And at least from my perspective, it seemed quite challenging. Now they're doing more of a slow compression. So the idea is that what they're pursuing is called magnetized target fusion, and it's a compromise between normal magnetic confinement, like a tokamak, and inertial confinement, like the NIF laser system. And so you start off with a magnetically confined plasma, and then you compress it a la inertial confinement. And so initially they were having this shockwave to provide much more extreme compression, so that it would be more similar to a NIF-like device. And now they're kind of smoothly pushing in liquid metal to compress it more slowly, less violently. And so now it's more towards the magnetic confinement tokamak-like approach. But I mean, so they're quite open with the community and engage. And the main thing that I'm worried about is the potential for the liquid metal, liquid lithium lead, to get into the plasma and contaminate it. The liquid metal is really elegant because it really solves your material science concerns of meaning that you don't have solid material that you know, gets weakened by neutron damage. But at the same time, one of the keys for getting good performance on the original tokamak in Russia was to just fastidiously clean the wall and make sure that you weren't having any impurities, any like large atoms like lead or nickel or whatever getting into the plasma. And it seems like if you have liquid right next to the plasma that's getting compressed, that there's a lot of potential for impurity contamination.
Yeah, if it's actually a separate substance that's physically compressing the plasma, it's very difficult to see how some of that is not going to get in there somehow and then radiate away all that energy that you've been trying to deliver to the heart of your plasma. And also providing that amount of energy density to a single point by like mechanical processes of physically pushing on an object is also just something that I honestly don't know whether it can or can't be done. But I remember there's some stories from very, very early in the days of fusion where people were almost trying to do this ballistically, like fire loads of pellets at your target fuel to see if you could compress it that way. And of course, it was just a non-starter because you need something with the spherical symmetry and the energy density, the sort of ability to deliver all that power to a point that a laser has to even start thinking about this stuff, from my perspective. But it would be wonderful if we were proved wrong, as ever.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, nothing would be better for the fusion community as well as the world as a whole for one of these startups to succeed. But one of the main things we were interested in from the startups is what triple product they'd achieved, because that kind of gives a sense of where they are currently. And we did a literature review, we asked a lot, and as far as we can tell, none of the startups have achieved the triple product that the T3 device in Russia in 1968 got. And so this was the device that kind of started the tokamak revolution in fusion. And so as far as we know, the startups have yet to match that.
There is one Helion energy, but I think if I remember correctly, their triple product was about the same as T3, right? But like the duration of their shot was two orders of magnitude, or maybe even three orders of magnitude shorter. So I think what Justin is saying is pretty amazing. And you know, the T3 tokamak, which I think was kind of built in 1968, so over 50 years ago now, these startups still haven't achieved the same level of plasma performance as something built over 50 years ago. It tells you just how good the tokamak concept actually is and how hard it will be to beat.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective. And, you know, thank you guys for going out and getting the actual data, because, of course, the issue with not all of these companies, and you've said that they vary in their degrees of openness and so on, is that, but, you know, if all you really see from someone is advertising copy where they say, and we've made a whole hour without saying it, but, you know, fusion in 20 years, if that's all they say with their advertising copy, then it's very difficult to know whether they have anything that can back up that kind of statement at all. But listeners too will remember that the T3 tokamak was the one which caused the column 5 to go over into the Soviet Union with their lasers to actually measure the temperature of the tokamak. And I suppose at the time it was extremely surprising to them, because there was a device that was outperforming all of their devices by miles and miles and miles. And to the extent that they actually felt the need to send people beyond the Iron Curtain to measure that it was really doing what it was supposed to. This is interesting then, because I suppose what all of these startups would say in response is, yes, we may not have achieved this yet, but there's always the potential that once we do make some breakthroughs, we could advance at a much faster pace. But again, it almost seems like when we look at how tokamaks advance, tokamak triple products and confinement times, they've been following this sort of, well, it's a bit like a Moore's law, isn't it? I guess you guys actually say in your book it's faster than Moore's law. But even with that in place, it still takes many years of continuous development of the tokamak concept to really get to the stage where we are now, where they're close to achieving break-even, where you get the same energy out as you put in, theoretically. So do you feel that even with all of these sort of fancy and physically complicated designs, if one of them does show promise, like the tokamak did in the 60s, it could still be another, you know, few decades of developing that device before it gets to the stage to compete with some of the more established contenders?
I'll just make a quick point, which is the basic fact is this, that they essentially need to get, they need to improve their triple product by about, depending on the device, I think 5 to 7 orders of magnitude.
Millions of times.
Yeah, exactly. To get close to something that would be viable. So yes, we're shooting for them and we're really hoping that they're going to get there, and there could be some amazing regime in which they do, but at the moment I think I'm you know, healthily skeptical, I would say. I'd love to be proved wrong.
I mean, the challenge is balancing the funding for new ideas versus the funding for ideas that have performed well in the past. And it's definitely good to fund new ideas. And the funding for startups is generally relatively small. So like even the biggest startup is TAE, that is about the same size as like employees around 100 people or 150 people. It's about the same size as the TCV staff here at the Swiss Plasma Center. So these aren't huge efforts, but I think the problem is if they undercut, like say the EDER effort of, EDER is trying to sustain funding for a device that takes 20 years to build, and these startups are saying that they can do fusion in 10. And so it, my worry is if it undercuts bigger efforts.
Although it does seem like the funding sources are a bit different, right?
Yeah, they're very different, yep. So you're talking about progress. One of the things that's really lacking in fusion is milestones of, like, from the public's perspective, it's really difficult to judge progress in fusion. And so it doesn't seem like any progress has been made, right? It's just you build a new device and there's new instabilities. But I mean, like, the instabilities that we're dealing with now are, micro instabilities that are these small turbulent fluctuations that cause energy to leak out of the device. Whereas in, the 1960s and 50s, we were talking about, these huge MHD stabilities that were causing the plasma to slam into the wall. And so people don't have real life experience with this stuff. And so it doesn't seem like much progress has been made.
Yeah, I feel like that graph, the sort of Moore's law graph of how tokamaks have improved, is still the best thing you can show to people when they're saying, why is it that we should fund your next tokamak again? Because you can show them that although the story can seem depressingly familiar in the sense that we built a device and then we encountered some new way that plasma behaves terribly, the real story behind that that's less easy to see is that actually everything that has been done has been incremental progress. I think one thing that reminds me of is the famous story of the Zeta project in Harwell, which is not too far away from where some of us are sitting now, which was heralded at the time as being the breakthrough of fusion energy. And then it turned out that the neutrons they observed weren't from thermonuclear reactions. And it was a big sort of embarrassment and an upset over that. But then a few months or years later, similar devices did achieve what Zeta was supposed to have achieved, and they did achieve thermonuclear fusion reactions. And that story, that progress, kind of got buried by the high-profile debacle over Zeta. I mean, do you think that maybe fusion scientists or people similar, and this is obviously part of why you've written your book, need to communicate with the public in a different way to avoid this kind of thing from happening? Or do you blame people who write headlines?
Yes, both. Definitely both. I mean, fusion is public communication for scientists in general is difficult, and especially for fusion, because, there's this, holy grail perception and mentality of, the energy problem is solved, carbon-free energy, right? And so it makes really flashy headlines. And so in a lot of respects, that's really good for fusion because it's much easier to sell than more abstract research. But on the other hand, it can really lead to miscommunications. And so I know it seems like whenever there's a fusion development, the thing that people are interested in is how many years until a fusion power plant, right? So a startup has a new concept. Reporters ask how long until this will be a power plant. And so for fusion researchers, I guess it's a challenge of setting expectations. And so you can give the most optimistic timeframe that you can, but then it leads to this perception that, fusion researchers are always saying that fusion is 20 years away. As far as concrete, like, steps to improve this, I mean, a big reason why we've written this book is to give the motivated layperson a perspective on fusion. And so if there's a reporter who's writing a story on fusion, this book is exactly targeted at them and will give them perspective on how to interpret the most recent development.
I think the book does a really good job of explaining the history and science, and as well a lot of the power plant design concerns, which is quite esoteric and is a discussion, I guess, that has not really had that much in the popular coverage of fusion. The real engineering practicalities of getting this thing to work. When it came to analogies for fusion, I really liked the one about mini golf holes, I also interviewed Zach Wienersmith for this show, and he had this book Soonish, which was all about forthcoming technologies. And his fusion analogy, I don't know if you've read it, was about shy, geeky people at a party. You know, it's difficult to get them to couple up at first, but once they overcome the potential barrier, they're inseparable, and a lot of energy is released. So, which aspects of the science of fusion did you find most difficult to explain? And you know, how did you come up with some of these analogies to help explain them?
So getting people kind of updated with the state-of-the-art research, obviously that takes quite a bit of background. So, for example, I don't think it's ever mentioned, or it's very hard to actually get a grasp of what people are researching in fusion, at least physicists, if you're just a layperson and you don't have the time to go through research papers and see what people are doing. So I thought introducing things such as turbulence was quite challenging and doing it at the right level. Also, the talking about how much various breakthroughs have contributed to the field. So especially multi-scale computing, right, where you can parallelize thousands, if not tens of thousands, of processors, and how you can use that in the right way. And finally, the bootstrap current, like Justin was saying, because I think it's safe to say without the bootstrap current, we would be a lot further away from our current goal than is currently the case. So we really tried to equip people not only with the knowledge, but the tools to think about fusion such that, you know, in the future when ITER does inevitably turn on and we start getting results from it, and a few other tokamaks and other fusion startups are going to be reporting interesting results, which I hope happens quite soon, people will be able to say, I understand these principles, and I have a bit of insight as to how worthy this story is.
As far as analogies, I mean, I think just everyday life is the best source of analogies. I think all of us have been at the party that Zach Wienersmith is describing, where we initially feel shy and then meet someone that we really has something to talk to about. And so just there's lots, especially living in Switzerland, which is such a multicultural society, is driven home the fact that there's just so many commonalities between people from all over the world. And that's really what you need for communicating some of these really technical scientific principles, is to put it in terms of things that everyone is familiar with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's such an interesting challenge, because I've certainly found, especially with this show where I'm trying to explain things about physics in an audio format, one of the real challenges is getting across what I want to do, what I want to explain, without pointing at an equation ever. So I had this one episode where I tried to explain the semi-empirical mass formula and sort of the approximation to the mass of the nuclei. And, you know, hopefully those hardy survivors who did listen to all of that episode will say, oh, you did a great job. But there were a lot of times where I wanted to point to an equation. And your book is quite, there's equations in there. And you don't go through the whole sort of Stephen Hawking route of just having one, but you can understand the broad strokes of the physics without really looking at them.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool how, not, I wouldn't say easy, but if you have the right analogy, how much physical insight you can get into physics just through everyday occurrences. I think that's really really nice.
Well, our world has a very good physics engine that we're all quite familiar with.
Yeah.
Did you try to trace each term in the semi-empirical mass formula to a different aspect of attending a party, or
that would have been a good idea? I don't know how one would work out the asymmetry term for a party. Although, you know, I suppose maybe you could, like, different rooms are filling up at different rates, and
good luck with that.
You guys have got me in trouble now. I'm going to spend all day trying to work out how to do this. When it comes to studying the history of fusion, there's lots of different fascinating characters who show up. You have Lyman Spitzer, you have people like Ronald Richter, who was not really a fusion scientist, but more of a fraudster, I guess. So when you're looking through this fusion narrative, and as fusion scientists yourselves, Did you find yourself kind of identifying with some of the heroes of the fusion narrative in the story, or equally, were there any sort of unusual or strange characters that you particularly view with the fondness and or alarm? I mean, certainly from what I've looked at, Edward Teller is one of those where, although, you know, he made his contribution to the development of fusion and nuclear physics, as a character, he's interesting to say the least.
Yeah, so, going through the history of fusion, I didn't really identify with any of them, but I really appreciated Lyman Spitzer's perspective, because he's, you know, at the very early days of fusion, the US and the Soviet Union really led everything. And so I can't read Russian, and so I don't really have much of a perspective into the early days of the Soviet program. But Spitzer really shows, like, in the just when this is just barely getting off the ground, what they thought of it. And so recently I read a report of Spitzer from like 1952 or something, very early on. And it's amazing how much they already know. He's already talking about turbulence. He says, we have no evidence either for or against the hypothesis that there is turbulence in the plasma. Just technically, it's really impressive. And I really admire how much of a perspective and how, I guess, empirical and scientific he was about the whole endeavor. One of the good things about fusion is that it's a pretty small community. And so, and it's only been going on for 70 years. So a lot of the leaders are from the early days are still alive. And so, you know, walking around Cullum Lab, you run into, not people that are famous outside of fusion, but you run into the greats from plasma theory, and it's humbling.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I was at the US Fusion Theory Conference, which is called Sherwood, sometime last month, and it was the 70th, was it the 70th or 60th? I think it was the 60th anniversary of it. One of the people who organized the first Fusion Theory Conference, Russell Coulthard, he was there, and he's still at PPPL. And this guy is just like a giant in the field. If you read lots of the initial papers on MHD stability and magnetic geometry, he was the pioneer of this stuff. I think, as for, like Justin, I didn't really identify with any of the characters, just for various reasons. But I think as a theorist, someone who really who I really had a lot of respect for and really wish I could have met at some point was Marshall Rosenbluth. He was basically just, I think he was known as the Pope of plasma physics. And he was just like, like an infinite source of knowledge and insight. And in my research, I mean, I'm reading quite a few of the papers and comparing things, some of my results with him, and kind of like what Justin was saying, in terms of Spitzer knowing a lot, like Spitzer already knew that turbulent transport could be a problem. Rosenbluth, like in some of these instabilities that I'm looking at, like he had a huge amount of insight. And it's just, yeah, I really wish I could, I aspire to be as prodigious as someone like him one day. So that was, he's really impressive figure. Also worked on the nuclear bomb project, I think. But yeah, amazing physicist.
Yeah, we've done quite a few shows about the nuclear bomb project, both in the US and in the USSR. And it never ceases to strike me how you do have this remarkable group of individuals that come out from these projects. You have Sakharov in the Soviet Union, and plenty of different people like Oppenheimer and so on in the US side. And the sort of narratives and stories that come out of that in this era that really, in many ways, changed the world. Because, I mean, the releasing of nuclear energy, if there was no nuclear bomb, the geopolitics of the world that we live in today would be very different. I think we would have had more wars for a start.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that someone sooner or later would have figured it out.
Oh, of course. Yeah. But whenever anything like that is born, there's always some quite interesting stories that come out of it, I suppose. So on a similar topic, one of the arguments that you advanced for fusion early on is the idea that it allows countries to have nuclear energy technology without as big a risk of nuclear proliferation. Could you outline some of the differences and why it is that fusion is less useful for people who want to develop nuclear weapons?
So I think one of the most important facts to always have at the back of your mind is that for any nuclear weapon, you need fissile material. If you had a world without any fissile material stocks around, so no fission power, no nuclear weapons, it would be exceedingly hard you'd first need to acquire some new nuclear material. There's no such thing as a pure fusion nuclear weapon. You can't use chemical explosives to start off a fusion reaction in a bomb. And people have tried and it hasn't worked. So I guess the point is that fusion power by itself with no fission power has severely, I think, decreased proliferation risks. There are proliferation risks, which Justin and I can go into. If you have both fission and fusion coexisting at the same time, the increased availability of things like tritium from the fusion plants isn't really a significant risk in terms of using the tritium or whatever to boost your nuclear weapons. So Justin and I spent quite a lot of time thinking about this, and I think that the main picture is that fusion has a minimal proliferation risk. That the thing that was most concerning to Justin and I was the use of a fusion reactor as a very intense neutron source. So suddenly you've got these high energy neutrons coming out at a very high flux from a fusion reactor, and people have speculated that someone who would like to proliferate, an agent that wants to do that, could clandestinely put fertile material, so that's material that can be made fissile by absorbing neutrons or whatever. You can inject that into the blanket, like the tritium blanket, of a fusion reactor, and you could use the fusion neutrons to enrich the material. And calculations have shown that if you put fertile material like uranium-233 into a like a gigawatt sized fusion plant, then in as little as 2 days you could actually create enough material to build a nuclear weapon. So like an actual it's probably several kilograms that you need to, a significant quantity is defined as how much you need to build a nuclear device. The problem is, and the good thing is that it would require several weeks to actually take it out of the device and process it. So as long as you have very strict monitoring on your fusion plants, and if you assume that you see any fissile material or kind of, you know, fertile material on site that they're trying to proliferate, then you've actually got a system that is very easy to control.
So broadly speaking, I mean, the difference here is that fusion devices are using these light isotopes, which aren't really fuel for nuclear bombs per se, and fission devices, you're having lots of heavy isotopes, which basically are nuclear bomb fuel. I mean, it's almost, you almost have a nuclear bomb that's just being slowed down in its explosion, and that's what a fission plant is.
Exactly, yeah. And so in a fission plant, in normal operation, you have plutonium, you have uranium all over the place. And so if you detect plutonium in a fission power plant, that's nothing special because it's supposed to be there. But in a fusion power plant, you can have sensors, and the moment they detect plutonium, the moment they detect uranium, alarms can go off. Everyone knows that, you know, people are being evil and that something should stop. And so as long as you have, say, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Authority, monitoring sites, you can be sure that you can't proliferate because the stuff is easy to detect and shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm. And then you combine this with the enhanced safety risk of the fact that, you know, the failure mode for a tokamak is essentially the worst thing that will happen is you might destroy your tokamak, but you're not going to spread radioactive material over Chernobyl-like distances and so on. Yeah, so there's this issue of nuclear waste. So obviously in a fission power plant, the nuclear waste is this waste fuel, which are the sort of fragments of your nuclei that have split apart, and they remain radioactive for thousands of years and need to be buried underground and all this sort of thing, in specially designed facilities with special markings on the outside that could be recognized even with future civilizations that have lost the use of language, and all sorts of crazy things have to happen for responsible disposal of fission waste. There is a lot of waste from fusion as well, though, in the sense that this intense neutron bombardment on components of the reactor and the first wall and things along this line does produce radioactive material. So do you want to talk a little bit about some of the waste concerns, the nuclear waste concerns from fusion, and how they sort of match up to fission?
You made a good summary. So in fission, you have the fission products that are inherently radioactive, and there's really no way around that. For fusion, the neutron that comes off can activate the first wall, it can activate just components around. But that's the important difference is in designing our power plant, we get to choose what we put around. So the radioactive waste is there, but it's not intrinsic. And so we can, as we get better at fusion, we can design the first wall, design the surrounding components to minimize the type, the danger of the radioactive waste, as well as its amount, as well as its lifetime. And so, you know, just from the start, even if you do things, you know, very simplistically, the amount of radioactive waste in a fusion plant is somewhere around 1,000 times less than in a fission plant. And instead of lasting for tens or hundreds of thousands of years, most estimates are that it would waste from a fusion plant would be safe in 100 years, 200 years, something like that. And then, you know, you can get better over time.
And this is, of course, another aspect that makes fusion potentially more economical than fission, because a big part of what people don't like about investing in fission plants is this long-term commitment to safeguarding the waste. When it comes to the fuel for fusion plants, most of the plants that are being operated at the moment, like JET and eventually ITER, are running on deuterium-tritium fusion reactions. And I think ultimately the aim would probably be to move to deuterium-deuterium fusion, because tritium is kind of hard to get your hands on. And there are currently schemes to recover some of the tritium or make more tritium as part of your fusion reactor's running cycle. So, I mean, how feasible do you think, how much of a concern do you think the fuel is for fusion power plants, in particular tritium, and trying to recover that from the reactor?
Well, quickly, just to say, by the way, so only two tokamaks have actually ever operated DT. Most of them are operating at levels where the fusion power is negligible. They're just, because tritium requires all kinds of licensing and stuff.
I see. But when they're running their shots to get as much power as possible, they operate in DT. Is that right?
No, only two tokamaks have ever actually done DT. There was TFTR in Princeton, which first did it in 1991, and then JET did it a few years afterwards. But we haven't actually had any large-scale DT tokamak campaign since 1997.
Yeah, so the general idea is that tritium is expensive, it's radioactive, it's just a huge headache. Mm-hmm. And so most experiments run on pure deuterium. So they produce relatively little fusion power, like very little fusion power. And you understand how the plasma behaves. And it's pretty straightforward to understand how a DT plasma, a deuterium-tritium plasma, would have behaved. So the plasmas behave pretty much the same. And then you can imagine how much power would have been produced.
I see. So, but in the long term, for, I guess, the first practical tokamak power plant demo, the plan there is to run with DT or with DD?
So power plants would have to use deuterium tritium. And so as far as getting tritium, it's definitely true. I think power plants have to be self-sufficient, meaning they produce as much deuterium as they consume. And that's by using a lithium breeding reaction with a neutron. And so it is a challenge, and it's particularly challenging because we've never been able to experimentally test this. So the few devices, so JET and TFTR, that have used deuterium-tritium as fuel didn't produce very long plasma discharges, so they didn't produce very many deuterium-tritium neutrons. And so you can't actually test experimentally the schemes to generate tritium. And so the physics of it are pretty well known. So you can use neutronics codes that are used for nuclear bombs or whatever. You can use these codes to model the behavior of the neutrons and to calculate how much tritium would be generated if you set up your reactor in some certain way. And so there are codes that calculate this. And so I'm convinced that this is a solvable problem. I think like I'm much more, for instance, mm-hmm. concerned about disruptions than I am about tritium breeding. That being said, it hasn't been experimentally tested yet. And it will be an engineering challenge because tritium is really precious. And so you can't lose it. You have to be really careful about
margins. It might be useful to say that ITER is testing a variety of tritium blanket concepts, but it's not going to be self-sufficient in tritium just because most of the wall is going to be covered in diagnostics and heating and whatnot.
Yes, because it's an experiment rather than a power plant prototype. So ITER is due to be switched on if there are no more delays in a few years. Could you take us through what ITER is going to do when it's switched on and what are going to be the sort of major milestones to look for, the major achievements that this particular experiment has hoped to have, and you know, some of the maybe perils and pitfalls that you might see along the way as well?
So like most fusion experiment or most big fusion experiments, it'll be switched on in stages. And so 2025 is the date for the first plasma. And so initially they'll be operating very conservatively without a lot of different heating systems. And so this will be just basically proof of principle. We can create a plasma. Interestingly, ITER will be so good at fusion that it won't be able to use deuterium-tuterium even because it would create too many deuterium-deuterium neutrons. And so it will be running, I think, with either helium or just normal hydrogen initially. And then these preliminary experiments will be used to study how the plasma behaves, and then you just gradually increase performance, right? So heating systems will be gradually added to it, and more aggressive discharges will be used. And of course, during this time, you're going to be looking for disruptions, right? And trying to figure out how they behave, because in the early stages, you can use really, puny plasma discharges mm-hmm. to figure out how things work and then gradually move them up. Because of course you don't want to damage the device. And then ultimately about 10 years later, right now it's scheduled for 2035, will be the first deuterium tritium experiment. And so that's when kind of the full might of ITER will be unleashed. And that's when you'll install the tritium breeding modules, potentially would be sometime after that, to test tritium breeding schemes. And so they already have, they already have kind of the general experimental, the shape of the general experimental program set up in that way, just to minimize.
So it's fair to say that maybe perhaps the primary goal of the first 10 years is to see how the plasma and the reactor behave compared to, you know, the theoretical models of how it will behave, particularly sort of seeking that upper limit of how high you can push the plasma density and so on until you start hitting these disruptions. And then subsequently is when they go for their, as in Jet's case. I mean, Jet, I think, was originally built in 1983, and then they didn't really hit their peak power until 1997. So again, there was a stage where there was sort of 10 years of experimenting with the device and learning as much as they could from it before they went for their peak plasma power shot, I guess. And it seems like we'll be following a similar sort of cycle for ITER.
But even the early days of ITER will be really interesting. So seeing, Jason was talking about this pedestal that exists at the edge of the plasma, and so just seeing what the pedestal looks like, how good it is, will be something that could be seen before going to full deuterium tritium shots, and that will tell us a lot about what the performance will be.
So it's really a moment of truth when people start getting data out of that will come fairly shortly after the thing is first switched on, which is, you know, looming at this stage. How do you feel? Just sort of, there was a wonderful article that you linked to in the book when you were talking about ITER, which detailed this stage where ITER was in considerable difficulty And, you know, ultimately the project had to be delayed and the head was replaced by Bernard Bigot, who was quoted, I think, on the cover of the book, which was quite a coup. Do you view ITER as being a project that is now in safer hands and going to go ahead on time, or is there still the potential for things to get delayed and go wrong with it?
I mean, there's always uncertainty, right, especially with large engineering projects like this, but it does seem in the past few years that things have been on schedule, so that's been really promising.
Yeah, things definitely look better than in that. I think it was around 2014 when things were really seeming mm-hmm. like they're going through a critical stage. Things seem on a better track now. It is important to keep in mind that ITER is just like an immensely ambitious experiment, right? Like I think it is the world's biggest scientific collaboration. And so we've talked exclusively about technical challenges of ITER, but the political challenges are in a lot of ways just as formidable. Of the ITER project was founded by a treaty between Reagan and Gorbachev. And so there's mm-hmm. all sorts of political challenges that then cause logistical challenges to the project as well.
And the Americans themselves have not necessarily been the best contributors and most sort of faithful partners in this endeavor. But I suppose in some ways, given the way that global politics works, it's kind of amazing that the project has held together across those decades with the partners that it's had for so long.
Yeah, I mean, these large international projects have a lot of inertia, which can be good. So like when it was going through the challenges in 2014, having this big political weight behind it, I mean, it's hard to change, which can be a good thing. But then on the other hand, yeah, trying to keep, 35 different countries on the same page for 20 years is just incredible.
So looking to the future, there is one question I'd like to ask that's not actually that much related to fusion, but I just think that you guys will have interesting perspectives on it, because we've done a lot of episodes on this show about the future of humanity. We've had series about existential risks, artificial intelligence, this sort of double-edged sword that arises when new technologies arise, and the fact that technological developments can often offer us great improvements to our lives while also exposing us all to great risks. I mean, where do you view the trajectory that our species is headed on? And I guess what role do you think fusion will have to play in that in the future?
I think, the future of humanity is obviously a fascinating but and huge topic. I would say for fusion itself, something that makes me optimistic about the future is fusion, because if we manage to get it working, you've mentioned these technological double-edged swords, right? It's you have some kind of scientific and technological breakthrough that gives you this new capability, but it's really up to humans and how we organize ourselves to determine whether we curtail the worst elements of it and optimize the best. And fusion, commercial fusion, really is a shining example of how humanity says, look, we have the ability to blow ourselves up, many times over with nuclear weapons, but we didn't do it. Instead, what we did is we actually worked on something that was extremely hard for over a century, or roughly a century, hopefully, from the time fusion research began, in an international effort that required long-term vision and investment beyond our own lifetimes, even. And we actually came to the point where we can now build fusion reactors. So I think just from a psychological perspective, if we do that, that would be incredible, because knowledge of the strong nuclear force and nuclear binding energy, that's probably the sharpest double-edged sword we've discovered so far, right? Obviously, we still have nuclear weapons. That's the other side to deal with. But at least we did something good with it. And I think fission power is also a good example of something good. But fusion is a lot harder and even better. And then, secondly, fusion is exciting because we talked a lot about electricity generation and all that kind of stuff. But I think really, from what Justin and I concluded from our investigation for the book, is that if you want either manned interstellar, if you want manned interstellar or even interplanetary travel to the outer bodies of the solar system, then fusion really is the ideal fuel for that. And for interstellar travel, chemical is just not going to do it at all. Fission is marginal and you need fusion. So I think fusion is really, it's a technology that enables the stars to open to our species, and it's something that in the long term we will look back on and be very, very glad that we invested in. And finally, what I would add to that is that lots of people at the moment are talking, I mean, obviously climate change and resource constraints, it's a huge problem. The thing I like about fusion is it's like this, it's a vision for the future of our species that is based on abundance and based, on us having very large amounts of resources to do useful things with rather than scarcity. And I happen to think that vision of humanity is a lot more inspiring than us just staying on this planet and living more frugally. So yeah, those are my two cents.
Okay. Well, just on this tangent, if I could, the interstellar travel and fusion is a really fascinating combination of topics that I'm sure the listeners will be intrigued by. So we've talked about it very briefly in one of our episodes on the Starshot project, which is this idea that you would launch sort of cube satellites into space using a big array of lasers on the ground that would, accelerate them to some appreciable fraction of the speed of light, which is the real bar for interstellar travel, is actually, either having a slower but sustained journey or something that's going at an appreciable fraction of light speed. Mm-hmm. And that these would launch these satellites to the nearest planet, the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, and have a look around. So why is it that fusion is the sort of superior fuel for use in these journeys? Is it just a matter of the fuel itself, or what leads you to these conclusions?
So it's really energy density, because the challenge is if you want to go really fast somewhere, you need a lot of fuel. But then at the start of the journey, you need to accelerate all of the fuel that you're going to use later in the journey. Mm-hmm. And so there's this exponential dependence. So basically, the weight of the fuel, you can spend all of your energy accelerating the weight of the fuel needed for later in your journey. Now, if the fuel weighs less, so basically if you can have more energy with less weight, then there's this beneficial feedback. It's an exponential dependence. So it's really helpful to have the highest energy densities possible. And so fusion is that. And so it's you can carry along the most energy possible with the least amount of weight.
Well, if I was really playing with fire, I could talk about antimatter, which probably gives you even higher energy density, but obviously has its own issues on account of how it can't come into contact with anything else.
Yep. We looked into that. It's a fascinating topic. And fusion, obviously, like we're struggling to make a device on Earth, to make a device that's lightweight enough to be put onto an interstellar spacecraft is much more challenging.
Mm-hmm. And so ETA's not going to fit on one.
Yeah, this is more speculative, but
of course.
Antimatter, is even more speculative than that. And so... Yeah, fusion.
But also, just to quickly say, for the Project Starshot, I mean, that's not a manned mission, right? They're these very, very...
No, of course not. No, you would never get that kind of payload out with that.
Yeah, so for something like that, I mean, what they're proposing seems to be ideal. But if you want to transport heavy things, then yeah, you need something where you carry your own fuel with you, it seems. Just as a quick number, if you want to get up to 5% of the speed of light with fusion. If you had a fusion propulsion system, you need to carry about the same amount of propellant. Well, half the mass of your ship has to be fuel. However, if you want to get up to 5% of the speed of light with fission, it's like you need to have thousands of times more fuel than you do with
payload.
Yeah, than the actual dry mass of your ship. And with chemical, like it's just you probably couldn't even get that fast with the whole mass of the solar system as fuel. So
yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly what the ratios are for, you know, the shuttles and things that are being used at the moment, but it is mostly fuel by mass, and then the payload is a much smaller fraction of it, I guess. Finally, then, I think amongst fusion scientists, and I think you've almost, both of you maybe have alluded to this a little bit earlier on, there's something of a cathedral mentality that has developed, which is, in other words, in the 1950s, when these real efforts towards fusion started, you could see why people might think that it could be relatively easy, because, you know, that in a few decades they'd gone from no one knew what a nucleus was to nuclei have been split to blow up cities in Japan. You know, that's a horrible thing that happened, but it just demonstrates the level of progress in the science over a very short era of time. And so it was perhaps perfectly feasible to think that in the same way that civilian fission power had become a reality, it might be possible to expect fusion to be providing even more power in an even better way within a few decades, and within the lifetimes of the experimenters. And now the timescale that we have, you know, depending on how, of course, all of these fusion startups pan out, is essentially saying that, you know, we might see a demonstration power plant constructed in 2050 or later. And, you know, although we are all staggeringly young people, we'll be getting on at that point. And it's clear that many of the people in 2019 who have discovered just what a challenge this project really is have had to kind of adopt a mentality that their beginning work will be completed by others in future generations, like, you know, the group of masons laying the stonework at the base of a cathedral, aware that they might never live to see the roof being built. And, you know, it comes to, Jason, in what you're saying about spreading beyond the stars. And I know there's all these thought in futurist circles about how the best thing you can do is to maximize the ability of humanity to spread amongst the stars, because then you enable, you know, trillions upon trillions of future humans to be born. And if you're the kind of person who likes to maximize utility functions, that's probably a good thing to do. But do you feel like this cathedral mentality is the mentality of the fusion community? And perhaps both of you, speaking from, you know, personal experience and the people that you've talked to, is it a field where you have to have a certain amount of idealism to succeed or try? Or is it just that you're working on an incredibly difficult and fascinating physics problem, and the long-term consequences of it provide a kind of extra incentive and motivation to keep going?
So I think it's a combination. Talking to people, I think scientific curiosity is a big reason why people get into the field. Like, just problems are very interesting to work on. Personally, like, even, you know, I'm really excited for the ITER project, but one of my motivations is the cathedral mentality of, you know, with climate change and resource usage, as Jason pointed out, we're kind of handicapping future generations a lot. And so it's great to know that we're building something that will be useful in the future, right? We're gathering knowledge about a topic that at some point or another will benefit mankind. And so, you know, fusion is the energy source of the universe. At some point, it will certainly become helpful. And it's nice to know that people now are giving that as knowledge as a gift to future generations.
Yeah, so I mean, what I would say is people are motivated by many different things. I honestly think that lots of people in fusion and kind of in turbulence research are really just motivated by the interesting plasma physics questions there are. I don't think, some people really mind if fusion works or not. Obviously, they would like it to work, but that's not their main motivation. And then you get other people at the other side of the spectrum who really, you know, are gunning for it to happen. I think it's, I kind of lie somewhere in between that. I think that you see the cathedral mentality. Some people don't want to be the cathedral masons. They want to build the whole thing, which is what startups are doing, right? Which is admirable for many reasons. And I think there's a good chance that, you know, people of our age will just live to see the roof being completed and, you know, the cathedral doing its thing. Just about. I hope we will see it. But even if I knew, for example, that it's not going to happen until after I die, I'd still continue to work on it, because it's a noble question and it's a fascinating question.
And I think we shouldn't be too confident in predicting the future, right? Like, we know for a fact that there's going to be just an immense change in the way we generate energy. And so we talk about timescales, but what we really should talk about is funding dollars for fusion, right? And so the distance to fusion can vary, like the time to fusion will vary dramatically about with how much we're pursuing it. And so, you know, who knows what the future holds.
Well, on that note, I would like to say thank you, Jason and Justin, very much for coming on the show. Their book, The Future of Fusion Energy, you can get a hold of on Amazon or indeed in many places where books are sold. And it is extremely worth your time. A very wonderful read. Explains the science more clearly than I think any popular book on fusion that I've seen, and contains all of the sort of fascinating historical anecdotes and stories that show up throughout the history of fusion. So it's very much worth your time. And thank you both very much for your time and coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Physical Attraction. My guests were Justin Ball and Jason Parisi. If you'd like to find out more, please do get their book, The Future of Fusion Energy, which is both a highly entertaining and highly informative read. They also both have websites in the same format, justin-ball.com and jason-parisi.com, and they can both be found on Twitter if you're into that sort of thing. Remember, comments, questions, concerns, feedback, etc. can all be directed to me on Twitter at physicspod, or via the contact form on our website at www.physicspodcast.com. It's always so wonderful to hear from listeners, and this is your chance to help me make the show as good as it can be. You can also help us out by leaving a review on iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, purchasing past bonus episodes from the website, or leaving a donation via the PayPal form on the website, or just telling as many people as possible about the show to help spread the word if you like what we do. Until next time then, take care.